And welcome to Stuff We See. This is Jim. Along with me is Teal. Hi there, Teal.
Hi. I was hoping for a fancy introduction, but I guess I'm just here today, and not in any special capacity.
Look, the last couple of weeks, I was battling a cold, which I've been over, but through this process, I lost my voice like a week ago, and I could hardly talk, and I'm surprised, but it still hasn't fully come back. I don't know why.
You can hear a little Martin Sheen in there.
Yeah, because like I feel like whenever I get this, and it's been a long time since I had a throat cold like this, that I can start going, Saigon. I can't believe I'm still in Saigon. I was hungry for a mission, and for my sins, they gave me one. And when it was over, I'd never want another. First, I couldn't believe they wanted Teal killed. Thank you. That was my Martin Sheen, everybody. Which, by the way, some of the narration was done by his brother.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Who's in this horrible, horrible, like ridiculously terrible, like, I mean, one of the worst sort of like horror type movies. And my wife and I recently saw it because It was on Amazon as part of Riff Tracks. They're the guys that from Mystery Science Theater 3000. And it was so goddamn funny. I mean, it was hilarious. I can't even remember the name of it.
Riff Tracks has saved quite a few films from obscurity.
And it is true.
And made us enjoy them all over again.
Yeah. But anyways, a little bit of sort of business housekeeping as I begin. This is Stuff We've Seen, if you're new to the program, people. just so you know, something I discovered recently, because we have so many episodes, like over 150 at this point. And if you listen to the podcast through like Apple Podcasts, they only keep the 100.
Oh, the previous 100, and then they...
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So if you're like new to the program and you want to hear the earlier episodes beyond the 100 that you could get on Apple Podcasts, you got to go over to stuffweseen.com.
Oh, I hear it's great.
Yeah, it's our site. But you can get access to all of the episodes there.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so I just wanted to mention that. And then also, again, hey, it's our show and we get to do what we want. And if you ever have anything to plug, Teal, you'll get to plug it. But I will continue to plug my book, Parental Guidance Suggested, available on Amazon in paperback, hardcover, and also Kindle.
Soon to be an audiobook by Charlie Sheen.
Yeah, that's right. I'm going to do an audiobook version, which might be the most fun, except I have to wait till my voice is...
No. Do it with your voice like this.
Yeah. Parental Guidance Suggested by James Kent. It's for young adults. but hey, here's the fun thing. If you're a listener of the program, I have ordered up a few additional paperbacks version of the book, and they'll be arriving at my house probably like next week. And so you, as the listener, I am going to do a fun little giveaway. If you are interested in reading the book and not supporting me by buying it, I am willing to give away. I got four copies to give away, signed copies. I will sign it, a little personal message to you. If you send me an email, and I'm going to give you actually my regular email address, is jameskent2 at icloud.com. And that's all lowercase, so James, then Kent, K-E-N-T, 2 at icloud.com. Send me an email. If you're one of the first four people to do that, I will send you off a copy. However, if I'm sending you a copy, you got to read it. Okay, you got to read it, and if you like it, you got to tell people.
I think that's a fair deal. Yeah.
Yeah, and also one thing is if I know you, like if you're a listener of the show, that's like somebody that's like a friend of ours that I know, you can support us and buy a copy of the book. You don't need a free
family
copy.
Members must buy.
family members, yes. If you're part of, but I mean, if there's somebody that's like, just like somebody that doesn't know us, but is a listener of the show, and if you've, you know, and that means if you've like, you know, written us before, like people like John Ford count, then certainly send me an email and I will get you a copy of the book. And then I hope you enjoy it. But that's
awesome.
A little gift for you, for the people who are listeners of the show, people who will listen.
Unfortunately, we don't have a theme to tie it into this episode like we did on the last one with the teens in trouble. This theme is really not on subject with that. So.
No, nothing we're going to talk about today has anything to do with kids in the 80s, I don't think. But we're going to get, we have like a kind of a main topic, but I just want to throw out, because Teal, as usual, I'm assuming you've seen nothing, but I've actually seen a couple of things.
Okay, great.
And I'm going to just mention them to you.
Okay.
All right. First one, it's kind of a weird little A24 movie, kind of magical realism, which is not my favorite genre, but it was enjoyable enough. It's a movie called Problemista.
Oh, yeah. I've heard about that. Yeah.
Yeah. That's kind of fun.
Now, what's your, you've mentioned this a few times recently, in fact, that you don't, I think in response to Mother Night.
Yeah.
You said, I don't like the magical realism stuff. And so I'm wondering, I'm trying to think of other filmmakers who do that. Maybe Del Toro at times, Amir Kostarikis maybe, in that movie Time of the Gypsies.
Which I did like, Time of the Gypsies.
Yeah. So I'm just trying, I'm just curious what your, why it is that magical realism in particular sort of doesn't work for you.
Well, it's funny because it's kind of a genre that it's not particular to Mexican filmmaking.
Right.
But the filmmaker in Problemista, I think it's with Julio Torres, he was a writer on Saturday Night Live, did some of the funniest skits that he, like Saturday Night Live, anything that was really oddball.
Okay.
And he was also part of this like short-lived HBO series called Los Spookies that I really enjoyed. And that's why I watched it. But he's got a very like interesting sort of sense of humor. And this is caked with a lot of fantasy magical realism in it.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, magical realism definitely is a South Central American type of, it comes from that tradition of storytelling frequently. At least what we get in the U.S. is coming from south of our border.
I guess it could be a little twee.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah. It's just a little too cutesy for you.
Yeah, like, you know, Michael Gondry, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like that, he did this one film, which by the way, it has like, I'm dropping the name, but he's also Mexican. And
Gael Garcia Bernal?
Exactly. Did you see that one? And it's got...
I did not see it.
Do you know what I'm talking about? It's got, yes, Charlotte Gainsbourg in it.
Yes.
That has got a lot of magic realism in it.
Okay, yeah.
I'm not saying I hate it. It's just not my favorite genre.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I was just curious.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to, if I hear it's magical realism, I don't run away, but.
Right.
So I saw that. Then a film that I've been wanting to see, I watched, it's streaming now, is Late Night with the Devil.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, you can't watch it because it's not October.
That's right. I have to wait till, I'm putting it on my list of things I'll watch in October.
I wanted to see it. So I, you know. I couldn't wait to watch it. And my wife, you know, if I mention horror, kind of she's in.
Yeah.
It isn't a scary movie at all. And it's more about a concept, but it is fun. Like, I actually found it kind of a fun little hour and a half movie to watch.
Well, that's nice. I could use some of those after, you know, some of the things I've watched.
Yes. we're going to get to that. So that's another quick hit. Again, I don't want to get into that because, you know, you haven't seen it.
Right.
And then the big movie for me, and it's a strong recommendation, big rave for me, is Alex Garland's Civil War.
Now, this is a movie where I don't mind if I get some spoilers, so feel free to talk about it.
I'm going to talk about it, but it's not something that I want to, like, you know, I'm not going to spoil big plot points or something.
Right, but my point is I don't mind, you know, sometimes I really care about not hearing about a movie, but this one, I feel like I know enough about it already that...
Again, I think people are now at least familiar with this movie that's out there, and there's some discourse going on. There's those that love it, and then there's those that, what bothers them is they're too tied into what is maybe happening in the political state in America today.
Right.
And not being able to break away into sort of a fantasy dystopian possible future because they can't see how things could be the way this movie is.
Right, without drawing direct lines to contemporary politics, yeah.
Yeah, because the movie kind of drops you in media res,
yeah,
into a situation, and there's been a conflict, and America's in a civil war, but he, Alex Garland, doesn't give you a ton of details, and you have to kind of figure your way through this maze.
Right.
And some of the details that he does give you, the information bits in the movie, it kind of messes with your mind a bit because you're trying to figure out, well, how did that play out? Like,
right.
How does California and Texas? Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, but then there's more. There's a Florida alliance.
Okay.
And that's several states. And then there's this, like, up in sort of the Montana, Idaho area. There's another breakaway.
Okay.
And you don't really know, like, just because there's these factions, and then there's the ones that are sort of still part of the United States.
Right.
They're loyal to the United States. But you don't know what any of that means. So you don't know, like, Florida Alliance.
Well, right.
There's these states aligned with Florida. Are they also aligned with these, the California and Texas are called the Western Forces.
Right.
And you don't really know how these things are interplaying. And then what bothers people most, if you see the states that are still loyal to the United States, there are some of them are, you know, New England and New York and other states that you might think of as more liberal states. And so it messes people up thinking, well, is the president, who's clearly a dictator at this
right.
point, is he some kind of left-wing person? Like, you don't really know, and the movie doesn't give you answers. I would say that if you're a smart film goer,
you can figure it out.
Right, but then even later, as I've kind of decided what I feel like,
yeah,
is that, well, but the movie doesn't give it 100%, so, you know, if you were somebody that was more leaning right or very right, you could certainly make your own assumptions and just because based on how you think that liberals are these evil people, right?
Right.
Then
right.
you might think that, oh, this president who's played by Nick Offerman, he's gone crazy liberal.
Right.
That's interesting to me. I think that's fascinating that Alex Garland is giving a film that everybody can kind of see.
Right, but if it was slanted too far one way or the other, it would alienate half the audience. This way, it gets everyone to consider the possibility of disintegration.
Yeah, what I would say is one thing is very clear. This is what I think, that it doesn't matter what all the particulars are, is that the person who is the president is given himself a third term, is considered by all fronts a dictator, and has banned the FBI. He's disbanded the FBI. And if you try to go to the Capitol and you're a journalist,
yeah,
you are more than likely going to be executed.
Wow. Okay.
So if you pick those details up, it isn't hard to imagine
right.
that this person, he's probably right-wing. However, it doesn't matter. What it is that it's a person who is completely unhinged from reality.
Right, and totally subverting the process.
And so what I think ultimately, and I think smartly, Alex Garland may be making a commentary on, if you take somebody who was the president of the United States, Trump,
yeah,
and he tried to keep himself in office through a violent insurrection.
Yeah.
And also all sorts of fraudulent ways. And we ignored that. And we ended up voting for that person again in office. Well, that's a person who's unhinged from reality.
Yeah.
And what would he do once he's back in office?
And doesn't have the checks and balances.
Right. And so what I think this film is suggesting is that no matter who that person is, who is so unhinged from reality without the checks and balances, when they start doing that, it doesn't matter which side you think a state is on, you might start to say, America is about something more than this insanity, and we need to band together to get rid of this guy, which is what seems to be happening in the movie.
Okay, interesting.
And so with all that that I'm taking in, I was like loving this. And pretty early on in this film, you know, I am always one of these people where I know where I am on board on a film.
Yeah, yeah.
And even more importantly, I know, am I in the hands of a filmmaker who's making something different? And there are things that happen early on in this film in the style that Alex Garland is directing that I'm like, okay, I'm grooving with this movie. The choices he uses for the soundtrack.
Oh, interesting.
His sound design, the editing, the cinematography. There is a vibe going on in this film that is kind of electrifying.
Wow. Okay, because I don't necessarily get that from his other films.
He hasn't made that many movies.
No, but he wrote some books too.
Right. But any of the films he's directed, nothing has come close to this.
Okay, that's fascinating.
It's almost like he just channeled something else. And you said something to me once, not on the show, but you know, you're a writing professor.
Yeah.
And you once talked about a student who, an older student, and they wanted to write some kind of story about Trump.
Yes, and it was sort of futuristic.
Yeah. Yeah. And you steered him away from using Trump as a subject, that a story is much more interesting when you're not just giving people these expectations.
Exactly, yeah.
And I thought about that when I watched this movie. There's a lot of people struggling because they feel like, well, you know, they want it to be a right-wing dictator and
right.
Have a very clear delineation. And they want a civil war playing out as almost they imagined it might play out today.
Right, with red versus blue states kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That isn't going to serve beyond maybe some entertainment and getting polarizing even more sides.
Right. Well, yeah, it wouldn't accomplish much.
Right. And so Alex Garland, I think, wisely steps aside from that, and he gives us something way more interesting.
And the movie's doing pretty well, huh?
Well, I think it's one of these things. You walk away from this film, and you start talking about it to people. Like,
yeah.
You know, you might want to check this out, because in the theater, it's a real visceral experience. There are moments that are very intense, and I was kind of prepared for it. My wife, she found it really unnerving at parts.
Oh, interesting. Because of the political stuff or just the combat stuff?
Well, because the whole thing is very intense. Because Garland, we live in a country where everyone's wearing camo.
Right.
Hunters, that you can't even tell what side someone's on because of what they wear.
Right.
This film is filled with militia groups and other things. And as this little entourage of journalists go,
yeah,
they're trying to make their way from New York to the Capitol because they feel like the Capitol. One guy wants to find a way to interview the president. That's his like big thing.
Okay.
So that's their kind of apocalypse now. They're going to go and see the president. Offerman. Why did it have to be Offerman? They had to make their way in a circuitous route through Pennsylvania.
Never get out of Pennsylvania.
But because of all of these various militia groups and different sides and factions, there are like, there's only certain ways that you can even try to get to the Capitol.
Oh, right, right, right. Okay.
And so, you know, they're going to encounter different things. But along the way, it's very disorienting because you just never know what side it is that
right.
They are like encamped with. Like if there's a skirmish or something, you're not quite sure
who you're rooting for. Right. You're not rooting for anyone, I guess. You're just, I guess you're just anti-war is the idea, right? Like war, is that sort of the idea behind the movie? That,
you know, it's funny. I kind of like the film does have a conclusion.
Yeah.
But this is a movie where I've thought a lot about afterwards. And that's to me is the mark of a great film. And
absolutely, yeah.
I realized that after this conclusion, that you could walk out thinking, okay, well, hey, now America's, you know, is it going to come back together again or whatever? But I realized with all these different factions that the conclusion of this movie might just be the beginning. The Civil War, depending on how all these factions are, might not be so unified.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, because like I actually was thinking things like, well, it's interesting that, you know, these New England states had ever, and New York, like they were still part of America. But I think in reality, just deciding that you're going to secede from a union and join another cause is easier said than done.
Of course, yeah.
And that if you think about it, California and Texas are the two most populated states in America and probably have the two biggest economies. And then a Florida alliance with other states. So like you might have these different factions now starting to formulate their own states. And there's no guarantee that the country is going to come back together as one United States.
Right. It may find peace through other means, like a five-state solution.
Yeah. And so to me, the ending of the film leaves a very provocative intrigue. And so, like, again, give me other movies that are going to give me this many different layers.
Well, no, and I'm always like, you know, I'm always looking for movies that make us think, or, you know, I always like a movie when I walk out of the theater and I see the world in a slightly different way.
Yeah, and so that's why I'm highly recommending people check this out. Plus, and this is the thing that everybody's talking about, I won't really get into details, but there's a 10-minute sequence that has Jesse Plemons in it, and it would not surprise me. I mean, it probably won't happen, but it wouldn't surprise me that...
See a nomination.
For supporting actor in that, you know, you occasionally used to get those like one scene performances that are so...
I saw him in the trailer and I was immediately, you know, there's probably 5 seconds of that scene in the trailer and I was immediately taken in by the scene.
It's the most unnerving scene in the whole film. Okay. It's so intense. And again, it's like this Plemons, he's a guy, because he has this really friendly look about him.
But he can be so evil.
He, like in Breaking Bad, you know, his characters. And so it was sort of a masterstroke, I guess, that the person who was supposed to play that role had to drop out for whatever reason within like a week or something before he was going to shoot. And Alex Garland was all in a panic. And Kirsten Dunst, who's married to Plemons, says, you know, I bet you if I talked to Jesse, he'd be interested in it. And they got him, and then now Garland's like, that was a masterstroke because the guy is so fucking good.
Right. Interesting. I wonder who it was before.
That hasn't been mentioned. So maybe it's a story just for the show. But it's so good.
Okay. Well, that's high recommendation from Jim.
Yes. Now, the rest of our program is the theme that Teal selected.
So let me give you a little setup.
Okay.
On why I selected this theme.
Sure.
So I sometimes hang out on Reddit.
Teal went to Reddit.
So every now and then I am on Reddit movie subreddits or whatnot. And over the last few years, I've seen this movie come up in comments repeatedly. And usually like, you know, the topic is something like, what is a movie that makes you think, what the fuck did I just watch? So that type of thing. And this keeps coming up. And so I realized this film has a little bit of a cult following. And so I was curious about it because and then the story behind the film is kind of interesting. And it just seemed like this weird little piece of cinema history that I wanted to check out. That said, I had no clue what I was getting into when I suggested we watch On the Silver Globe.
By who?
By Andre Zaleski.
And who's that?
Andrzej Zaleski is a French-Polish filmmaker who, I guess he's a boomer. I don't know when he was born exactly, but he started making films in Poland in the late 60s and had some conflicts with the government and had to leave Poland at one point. They kicked him out of the country. They lured him back in by telling him that he could make a film there. He went to make this film and... through some internal Communist Party politics, which are fairly complicated, the film was shut down 524 days into production.
But think about it. If you were somebody that like was making these financial decisions, and it cost a lot of money, apparently in Polish dollars.
Yes.
And you watched some of the footage, you might have been like, okay, Andre, it's time to cut this.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I can't believe the film even got into production with like, you know, it, just knowing what I know about, you know, how the Soviets worked their film industry, it seems like the Polish were not quite as in super authoritarian control, but also they wanted him to come back to Poland.
Well, I guess I don't know enough about modern Polish history, but yeah. the regimes had gotten pretty tight
yeah.
by the 70s. For those who are like, well, still, who's Andrzej Zawiski? First of all, he was born in 1940, so I don't think he qualifies as a boomer.
Okay.
He passed away a few years ago.
Yeah.
And he is the director, which the title that most people have now been starting to recognize him for is Possession.
Yeah, which also has a cult following and also yeah. shows up on those what the fuck did I just watch list.
Yeah. And, you know, so, you know, you were like, well, we're watching on the Silver Globe. I'm like, okay, I'm going to watch this thing. Now, this is my first comment on this movie is that it makes Possession seem like a rom-com.
And Possession is a twisted, strange movie.
Yeah, but it ain't got nothing on the Silver Globe. It ain't got nothing. I've seen, you know, I've been around the block when it comes to movies.
Yeah.
And I've seen a lot of films. And I watched 250 of the BFI. And there's a lot of weird shit on there. But I don't think I've ever seen a movie quite like this.
I don't know what to make of this thing exactly. I have feelings about it. I'm not sure if they're valid at all. But I after that, I said, what the hell? I don't think I've ever seen anything like it.
Yeah, it's pretty wild stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really hardcore sci-fi.
So I like the sci-fi stuff. I kind of wanted to read the books.
Yeah, which is his like grandfather wrote.
I think his uncle.
His uncle, okay.
Yeah, his uncle wrote this series of sci-fi novels that the film is based on, trilogy of sci-fi novels. I don't know the name because I actually don't know if they've ever been translated into English. But just a quick rundown of the plot: some astronauts crash land on a planet, and
I want to say that the uncle's like because you know in 1903 when the guy yeah. wrote the books, they didn't know. That life didn't exist on the moon.
Right.
So I think it was kind of this idea that, you know, the moon's pretty close. So,
yeah.
You know, people thought that, you know, the planets had people on them.
Absolutely. Yeah. And yeah, so it was, so they crash land and I think three of them end up surviving the crash and then the immediate aftermath. And they set about to start having children. And the movie covers multiple generations into the future of their descendants and the civilization, culture, religion, storytelling, factions, politics, all these elements that would come with a new civilization. And that goes on for quite a while. And then another astronaut shows up. And he is treated by the people there as a god. Oh, and also on this planet are these weird bird creature alien things.
The Sherns.
The Sherns, which are pretty creepy, actually, for people in suits.
Oh, but then of course, they end up having sex with these new inhabitants.
Yes.
And then they become these other things.
And then they become these other things. And it is all, I mean, it's just so hard to describe even what a scene in this movie is like because incredibly long takes, frequently very long takes and often dialogue that is total nonsense. Just these existential monologues like, what if glory is the only heart that we can see beyond the sun within ourselves?
Well, because all of them are like almost acting, they're acting, they're like, they actually are performing as if like, because there's this camera device.
Yes.
And a lot of times they're like picking it up and it's almost like an iPhone in a sense. And so they are theatrically performing as if they're like these weird Greek choruses.
Well, and one of the factions ends up being actors.
Yes.
And one of the religions is all about acting. And so they fight their battles with wooden swords. I mean, this, I don't know how to tell somebody what this movie is because visually I've never seen anything like it.
Well, I mean, so much. Visually, you're right. I mean, from this wide-angle photography.
Yeah.
Also, and I don't know, again, because he wasn't able to complete the film, the movie was like about 80% done, and a lot of the stuff that wasn't shot were probably, it seemed like they were more complex set pieces.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they were complex set pieces that would have cost more, basically.
Yeah. So what he did after they got the film out of hands and he could work on it, 10 years later, he realized that, you know, actors wouldn't look the same and other things. So what he did, which was interesting, is he just shot like sort of stream of conscious, like real footage of like Poland streets and sort of, you know, actual like what's happening in Poland. And then he narrates what's supposed to happen in between those scenes. And I didn't mind that. I didn't really feel like the movie is incomplete. And it's just kind of because again, the movie only wouldn't have made much more sense if he had completed all the stuff.
Right. Well, there's things like a guy goes into a building. You see him go into a building. Then there's narration of what happens, the scene that happens while he's in there. And then you see him come back out. It's not that disjointed compared to the rest of the movie.
That's the stuff that's a little disorienting because, you know, in a typical narrative film, you would see things like the mission and them landing and all right. these things that you don't get that help ground what the hell's going on. But one of the things, and again, it's not really explained, so you just don't know, but it's interesting is that these astronauts that live there, they quickly discover the aging process is rapid there.
Yes.
And of course, this isn't explained, but it feels like she's able to have a ton of babies because they get big really fast.
Right.
Really? Like, it seems like by the time that one astronaut's old, there's like a whole civilization.
Yeah. I think also a lot of the film, some of the scenes work on an allegorical level, not a realistic level. And so there's times in the film where we're not supposed to be taking it literally.
Think about this, right? If we don't know the sense of the time of like how rapid aging, it is quite possible, and this might kind of play with their sort of weird thoughts about life and death,
yeah,
is that these people may multiply very fast and die off fast. Like, think about these Sherns, the
right,
birds.
So it may not be hundreds of years. It may be 100 years with 20 generations.
I don't think it's that much time. It's sort of like, think about, you know, any other animals that don't have big, long
right,
lives.
Right, 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 right. Okay, yeah.
That's how I was taking it.
Yeah, anyway. No, you're right. I'd sort of forgotten that aging thing. And because there's the one character who also won't die. His aging slows down.
Then, oh, there's just so much. Yeah, so the one astronaut that shows up after, and because they have this weird like kind of like communications with the cameras. So like there's people, and mind you, there's the defunct Earth, and then there's a second Earth. So I think that they were just like looking to populate other planets because they're already, the astronauts, like the home base is not Earth. It's like another Earth.
Yeah, or if it is Earth, it's sort of a post-apocalyptic Earth.
Well, no, they talk about it being there's another Earth, an old Earth.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, the old Earth. Yeah. So they are just looking to repopulate or to populate planets. Yeah. Okay. So,
So the one guy who comes and he's like treated like a deity.
Yeah.
Right. He's been sent there by the other astronauts because one astronaut's having an affair with his girlfriend.
Right. But also they find the footage. So you talked about how they have a little camera. It's actually a found footage movie for part of it.
Well, how about this weird thing? And first I thought there was maybe something wrong with what I was watching, but I realized it wasn't, is that when you're watching like those big long takes where they're looking directly at this camera thing, there's all these weird jagged jump cuts.
Yes.
It's like second, like he's like a little bit just, it's so weird. I've never seen the effect used in a movie before.
I haven't either. Like yeah. Where there's like just a few frames missing.
We're not even scratching the surface, though, of like what visual insanity. Like, forget all the plot, which at some point you just like try to pick up what you can. The shit that goes on in this movie.
A lot of the dialogue is kind of isn't necessary to the plot. It's philosophical dialogue. And so you pick up the little plot pieces here and there and kind of grab what you can. But you're right that what you're in for is this audio-visual experience that is completely unique.
Yeah, and you know, we never get to see the spacecraft, so you don't really sense, but I got the sense that there's like, because later you have these like, the guys brought cannons and other things with, so clearly the spacecraft has all of this stuff, because I mean, how the frick are they making these costumes?
Right. Yeah, the spacecraft has stuff, but also like there's a scene where he says we need metal and saltpeter. And so he like teaches them how to make guns.
Yeah, he wants lead. Yeah. Lead. There's also a funny scene where he's wrestling with a guy in the water. And then you see this thing that looks like some kind of metal structure. It turns out that it was a mistake where there was a ladder left in.
Oh.
Because the other, I was like, where's this ladder? Like, is that like part of the spacecraft? And I found out later that it was a mistake.
Oh.
First of all, I don't think I've ever seen a movie with more amazing costumes in my life.
Unbelievable. Yeah. And to know that they, this I think was the most expensive film in Poland at the time, but they were still, they had very few resources. And did you watch the documentary?
No.
Oh, you didn't?
I didn't, no. I barely got through the movie.
Oh, you got to watch the documentary.
Oh, all right. I'm going to have to watch this documentary.
Yeah, there's a documentary about the making of.
I did not watch that.
That's how I know all these details.
The details I know is from what I read.
Yeah.
Yeah, limited resources, but they picked these amazing locations and this, they shot the cave stuff. It was shot in like these salt mines in Krakow.
Yes.
And that is phenomenal.
And they had to, they had to climb down these ladders and walk 2 kilometers underground to get to the, where they were shooting, and they were stuck down there, and they had to use special light that wouldn't that didn't have sparks in them because there was methane down there, and it would have burned them up. So yeah, they shot, and it's an unbelievable set. And the fact that it's, yeah, the salt mine is just, the whole time I didn't know it was a salt mine. I was just like, how, did they build this? Did they find, what the hell is this thing? Because it's so, it looks almost like an ancient remnant of the Maya or something.
You know, there's so much, there's these pleasures
yeah.
that this movie gives you from a visual standpoint.
I also have to say that the restoration is really nice.
Yeah, apparently because of the way he shot with a green filter to like filter out some colors, so it gives this whole weird look to the yeah. movie, that for years, film labs didn't know that, and they were always trying to correct it, and they couldn't get things right because they were so busy trying to correct it. And so it wasn't until digital restoration that they could get the film to look like it was supposed to look.
Because it looks beautiful. I mean, it looks like it was shot yesterday.
I mean, first of all, like, even though there's like, they're guys in costumes, the Sherns, like, it's the imagination.
Yes.
Then when you see like the hybrids.
Yes.
Oh my God, they were so creepy. And when they go to the city where the Sherns are living.
Yes.
And then you see somebody like a Shern looking out the window and they've got like lights on and they got like a flower and the thing. Like these little details
yeah.
were kind of messing my mind up. And then there's the end with like, the girl in the veil, that is like one of the creepiest images.
Oh, yeah, and they pull back the veil and you see her face and, yeah.
There's the weird sex orgy going on and he's climbing over the...
That they just walk through and I mean, that was another moment where I'm just like, you don't see movies with this kind of extra work. Right.
Exactly. Right. Everything today is all green screen.
Yes.
Extras are digital. And to see a film like this, and you know, like, they had to, like, get all these people. No wonder this movie cost a fortune.
Yeah. Yeah. And they've got all these people. And then there's that scene with the, I forget what they're called, the death something, but it, you know, they all have masks on, and he's, like, up on this mound, and they're all sitting around him. And it's like, that's serious makeup on, like, 50 people.
And then, I mean, you know, like it's one of the coup de grace. I mean, there's a lot of allegories to religion.
Yes.
And it's kind of interesting because it really does take you through sort of like, if you look at biblical, like, you know, you've got the start of man.
Yes.
And it's really interesting kind of like how religions and beliefs and stuff.
And how they evolve and how we make myths. And
there's a whole Christ narrative. And then, and that's like, you know, it's a little heavy handed because it's pretty clear by the end of it. But, this scene that he comes back after they've had their battles with the Sherns.
Yes.
And on the shore are all of these people, these sacrifices or of non-believers, whatever, that have been impaled.
Yes.
I don't even know how they pulled it off, but it is just.
Well, they show it in the documentary.
Oh, yeah, they do?
Yes. And it's amazing. And it was so cold while they were shooting that one of the actresses is interviewed in the documentary, and she says she had two hats on, two pairs of gloves, and those giant fur coats, and she was freezing, and these guys were naked up on top of these poles.
Yeah, because, I mean, think about it. It's not like they're like, okay, get up there real quick, and we're going to shoot it. Those people had to be up there for a really long time.
No, apparently they would. They'd get up there, they'd get the shot, and then they'd get them down. They had one of those, things for, like, working on telephone poles. They had those, the crane. And they'd go up and grab them and put them in a hut for 10 minutes and warm them up and then stick them back on the pole.
But from a visual standpoint,
unbelievable.
It looks like these people, like, that they were shoved through their ass.
Yes, and with their entrails hanging out.
It's repulsive, and it's also, I mean, shocking because I'm seeing things that I've never seen before in a movie.
Yeah.
And to not know until a few weeks ago this movie even existed. So I don't know if I really liked it, but I mean, it certainly was amazing.
I don't know if this is a movie you like or not. You know, I don't know if that even really is like a metric for this movie. It is its own singular thing that I've never seen anything like it. I don't think there will ever be anything like it. I appreciate it greatly for what it is. I don't know if I like it or dislike it, but I will say that as soon as I was done, I watched the first hour again.
That's pretty crazy.
Yeah. And I watched the documentary. But yeah, I watched the first hour again because I was just looking for the seeds of things that came later, and they are there. But it's so disorienting, the experience of watching this, because there is so little to hang on to in terms of plot and character. And
and then I thought it was like, you know, I was like, this can't get any crazier. But then it does, where you get the other astronaut, the guy who
yes.
had been having the affair, where, like, I couldn't even quite tell, like, what was going on, because some of the descendants on the other planet seemed to show up, and I don't know if they got there or something. That was a little unclear. But, like, suddenly this guy, there's, like, this rock and roll music playing.
And it's like you get this electric guitar, like, when this guy walks in.
Yeah, and I'm, like, instantly I'm, like, sitting up, like, this is interesting. And then he's got this, like, car that's, like, this, like, super long fin Cadillac, looks like a Batmobile.
With a siren on top, with a flashing light on top, and teeth on the front grill.
I'm, like, this movie is just totally nuts.
It's completely nuts. And it's, you know, the only person who could see even coming close to this is David Lynch.
Yeah, it's not a David Lynch style, but like in that weirdness, like.
But in the sense that it's like you haven't seen it before, it's coming from somebody's imagination and vision that's totally unique in that sense.
Clearly, it's very Eastern European because, you know, I mean, Tarkovsky came to mind a little
bit. Yes, yeah, absolutely. This would be a great double feature with Stalker. Or Solaris.
I get that there's something going on over there that was like different in how they viewed the medium. And I have to say, though, you know, if you're looking at like film language and what we expect, and, you know, we talked about this Alex Garland movie, and how I feel like what's bothering people is its film language is different than what people would expect out of a film. And the only hint is that it was done by A24. And that tells you it's not going to just be like a film about, you know.
Right. Because A24 does try to have a little bit more going on in their movies.
But this film, it is clearly new film language.
It is totally new film language. And so I watched, not the entire thing, but I watched several parts of several other of his films.
And I will admit that I have not.
In each one of them, whether or not I was involved in the story or what, I don't think he made anything nearly as strange as On the Silver Globe ever again. And some of them are fairly standard stories, but his camera movement in them is astounding.
Well, that's because it's the same cinematographer. The guy who shot Possession also shot this and shot some of his other films.
Yeah, and I'm telling you, the cinematography is absolutely astounding. I could not believe this film. These camera movements are so smooth, but they didn't have a Steadicam. And what I was really hoping for in the making of was to see a camera guy walking around with a camera to get these incredibly smooth moves, because it's done handheld, but it does not have shaky. It's not shaky cam. It looks like Steadicam.
Well, I think what they did was, because think about the time that the film came out or it was shot. It was like 76.
Yeah.
So I think what they did was they went to America and they talked to filmmaker Albert Brooks to get some of those helmet cams from his first film there.
Yeah. So, it's just
was that called Real Life, right?
Is it called Real Life?
And those guys
I love that movie.
Walking around with the helmet cam filming the family. But that's the whole, when I was thinking, I'm like, that's what it feels like, is somebody walking around with a helmet cam.
Yeah, well, and so apparently, like, on set, it was just this incredible environment where everyone was working as sort of a labor of love and totally devoted to this. And, you know, they shot for a year and a half. And they just became this incredibly close family that started to disintegrate towards the end. And this happy sense that they had started to fall apart. And so in a way, the shooting of it kind of mirrors what goes on in the film. And so they started to fall apart and people left. Like, they would just show up on set and the sound guy would be gone. Because people would literally run away from the movie, and so they would have to hire somebody else. There's several interviews with Zelowski in this film, and at one point he says, "Well, okay, setting this up, the actor who plays the second astronaut who comes in, he said every day Zelowski would be giving him new lines, and he would say, 'Here's the lines, do this in the scene,' and." These scenes are often long takes with fairly complex dialogue. And this actor says that he realized at some point that what Zelowski was giving him was lines from his diary. And that's what he was performing in some of these scenes.
Such a singular vision, because he literally just, he didn't know what he wanted to do at some point and how to end this thing.
Yeah. And so, he talks about in one of the interviews, he says, I am cinema. There is no difference between me and my films. We are the same thing. And the other filmmaker, it took me a second, the other filmmaker who this is said about frequently is that the person is inseparable from cinema is Godard.
I was reading some things and Godard was referenced in some of the comparisons.
Yeah, and I think that is kind of an apt comparison, but just the fact that, yeah, he was putting his diary entries into the film, and sort of, he's an incredibly charismatic guy who people would just follow. And so it seems like the movie, the shooting of the movie almost turned into a little cult around him that then disintegrated slowly, and then the Polish government came in and shut it down. So in the documentary, Andre Vida, I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name correctly. Vadya,
yeah.
So Zelowski, as a teenager, decided he wanted to make movies. And so he went and basically became Vadya's assistant at like 19.
Wow.
And was on set with him for everything. He was his protege and was trained by him. Vadya made this film that was incredibly controversial. It's a critique of socialism. Nobody really knew that that's what it was. Sorry, I can't find the title right now. But it was a subtle critique of socialism, and it really offended the government. And so one of the theories is that this guy who had recently taken over the film program for the government, as retaliation against Vadya, shut down Silver Globe. So there's all these weird little politics around it, and the money too. I mean, the money's definitely, that was his, he said, Poland shouldn't be spending money on films. We should only do television.
It is interesting about like these directors that kind of have a concept and then try to find their film throughout. That's more of a European thing. I don't think American directors necessarily do that. Like, so for instance, Fellini would do that. Like, he wasn't even, he would write the stuff afterwards. That's why everything is dubbed anyway. He didn't really think about what the people were going to actually say until he was in the editing room.
There is an American filmmaker who did this.
I wonder if we're going to be thinking the same thing. So I'm going to say it first.
Might not.
I think the last filmmaker that was allowed to do this was Michael Cimino with Gates of Heaven or Heaven's Gate. And that was what it cost too much money. He didn't really know what he was doing. He just kept on shooting.
Because I was going to say Apocalypse Now.
That's another thing too. Right. Right. They were there trying to create a journey.
Yeah.
Right. And that was sort of this thing where like, oh, the auteurs, let them find their movie. But then it started getting too expensive. And if they weren't exactly. Like, when people talk about like, well, the blockbuster changed everything. Well, no, it was that. Oh,
it was Heaven's Gate.
It was like, well, Jaws and Star Wars changed everything because like, oh, wait a minute. They had their vision, but they were contained and they made money.
Mm-hmm.
And they all, you know, and they, an audience, and this is what audiences want. So these, it's getting too expensive for these visionary directors. I mean, Deer Hunter was also something that the studio was very upset with until it came out and was a hit. And then, of course, he did this Heaven's Gate and bankrupted a studio. And I mean, think about it. After that, like, what are examples?
Oh, examples where?
Where a director was able to, like, after, like, 1980, when did director get to, like, just kind of make some epic film that they didn't really know what was going to happen and it worked out?
Kubrick.
Well, yeah, but he was, but he made, like, Full Metal Jacket, but he had a script.
Yeah, but there were a lot of changes. I read Matthew Modine's book about it. Yeah, he had a script, but there was a lot of changing the script, improvisation, changing things around. You know, they didn't just shoot that long because they were doing that many takes. They were figuring stuff out as they went.
Oh, you know what? Malick. Malick's the guy.
Malick can do it, yeah.
He not successfully in the last several films, but he just goes and shoots until he's satisfied and then edits for years.
Would you put, like, what's that last Ari Aster movie in there? Bo is Afraid.
Maybe. I mean, clearly he had a vision, but I mean,
I think they were clear about his vision ahead of time. Whereas On a Silver Globe, I think is, I mean, also, I don't know if you know this, but like the day after they shut it down in Poland, they didn't have passports because you're not allowed to leave the country. Within days of it shutting down, two men in black leather jackets came to Zulawski and handed him a passport and said, you need to leave the country in the next 24 hours.
That's crazy.
Yes. Yeah. So they didn't just shut his movie down.
It's amazing the film exists at all.
It's amazing. And that it looks so good. The restoration worked. It's not, you know, a bunch of like, oh, it doesn't look like it was shot in the 70s.
Maybe because it was European and it's also set in like an outer worldly thing. But I guess, you know, even though a lot of it doesn't fully make sense, plots a little bit, you know, I think a lot of people would be confused. What I did like about it beyond the amazing visuals and just nuttiness is the fact that when we think of sci-fi movies and what we usually get, this is a more interesting concept.
It's what science fiction is actually supposed to be, which is about ideas more than spaceships.
Yeah.
And about philosophical ideas. And that's what this movie is. It's a philosophical concept sort of played out in a really interesting way. But, you know, Star Wars has no ideas. A lot of science fiction writers wouldn't consider Star Wars science fiction.
Yeah, I mean, that's really pure escapism.
Yeah, it's space opera, which is, you know, you can't just use high technology in like the same kind of story you've always been doing. The story itself needs to have some kind of idea about it that is questioning what is reality or what does it mean to be human or those kinds of deeper questions. So like Philip K. Dick was great at getting at. Stanislav Lem, who wrote the book that Tarkovsky based Solaris on.
But ironically, what made the first two Star Wars movies and somewhat Jedi, but what really made those successful, And this is a nod to the film we're talking about.
Yeah.
And this is what today, I just think that film goers and people who make movies just don't seem to get. What made Star Wars ultimately so successful wasn't just this the amazing special effects, which were for the time, I mean, absolutely like whoa, is that they were grounded with like the real planet location, the Tatooine, because it was otherworldly, because just like in this film, he picked this location that didn't look like it was from our planet in a weird way. Same with Lucas. He thought, you know, this Tunisian desert and then building these weird structures, and they weren't like CGI structures or
right.
map paintings. Like, he had to build those things that like Luke lived on, and it made it feel real in a relatable way to us.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, in the second film, Hoth is like, they went out to like this cold thing. So it had this feel of like real, like cool, like a planet that you're on. And then in Endor, you know, is this forest. So you had these real locations, and it wasn't all like what you're seeing today, where everything is using that new, you know, blue screen technology there, that where like you have the traveling stuff in the background, and it looks pretty realistic.
It looks pretty realistic, but not that. Yeah. And that's basically what we see from, you watch some of that Rebel Moon, right? I imagine that's entirely CGI.
You know, I watched, when it first came out, the first part, I watched 20 minutes, and I can't remember anything of it. But I recently completed the new Shogun.
Oh, yeah.
And loved it. My whole family watched it. We loved it. But what I did notice is it's gorgeous. And there's probably some sets, and it is hard to know what's real and what's not. But I could tell these beautiful backgrounds that they're using that same technology that they're using now, which they started with the Mandalorian.
Yes.
And everything, it's like kind of like a soft focus, as if like mm-hmm. this is the way they've shot it. But you know that this background, that they're probably on a soundstage or something.
Of course they are.
It looks great, but I know. And of course I point this out, and then my wife's like, shut up, because you're ruining it.
I have the same problem. But I don't. Was there a single process shot in On the Silver Globe? I don't think so.
You don't even have to think so. No.
Yeah.
I mean, the stuff that they probably wanted to do something with is the stuff that they didn't get a chance to shoot.
The one scene that I really wish they had shot, but it would have been crazy expensive, is when he goes into the place at the end and sees all their little glowing brains and stuff.
Would have been awesome.
Yeah.
I know, again, see, I don't mind things that are just costumes and things.
Yeah.
If there is such a great concept and care and thought, and the costumes themselves, they like put so much heart into it, that I love the Sherns and I love their glowing eye thing. Everything about it, I was so fascinated because there's so much texture.
That's the perfect word for it. And not, I mean, in the costumes, but in everything in the movie.
Like those hybrid Sherns, those guys that will look like mole men.
Yeah.
How many masks did they have to fucking make?
Yeah, that's the scene I was talking about earlier. Yeah.
It's so crazy. How about there's just these little things that I remember, where like all those creepy like Sherrn slaves, the women that they have been spoiled by, that they're climbing up the stairs.
Yeah, the stairs are amazing. So here's just before I forget about it, an anecdote from the documentary, which I think you need to hear. When they're crucifying this guy.
Yes.
They show him being nailed in.
Yes.
And Zulawski insisted that they not use a collapsing nail because it would look fake.
Okay.
Right. So usually, like with a knife, the blade collapses into itself, right? And so you would have a collapsing nail that would collapse into itself when you hit it. He thought it would look fake. So they had a fake hand made so that they could actually do it. But the fake hand looked so fake that it was just such a poorly made fake hand that they couldn't use that either. So they got a hand from a medical school.
Oh my God.
And so they got a hand from a cadaver. They had a priest on set to make sure they were doing it all above board and not like desecrating this.
There's got to be a comedy that you could make of Zulawski's accountant on the film going, they want what? He wants to what? The fake? No, we must stop this madness. Why can't he use the fake nails? I mean, this is such craziness. And I don't know, you know, maybe people will search this out through this conversation, because we're having a good time here.
Yeah.
As we come to the end of this episode, just like realizing that there aren't many movies, honestly, that we can just kind of talk about stuff that is going on in the movie, because it's just so insane.
It's so insane. It's so, you know, Herzog, I might put in this category.
Yeah, I was going to bring him up earlier, and there's been some comparisons and that kind of thing with, like, you know, well, like with Fitzcarraldo. I mean, he goes in and, yeah. So, you know, look, we're always looking for movies that we didn't know about and have a history and might offer us something different. Again, I'm not recommending people run out and see this film because it's 2 hours and 45 minutes of just pure insanity.
But if you're up for that, if you want the experience, and the thing is, it's not a... I mean, I guess it is a different, but it wasn't a miserable experience for me. Like when it,
no, did, I mean,
it, when you first started watching it, you sent me a text like, what the hell have you done?
Yes. You hadn't seen it at that point, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, because it's like, because my whole thing is the BFI, I saw 250 films and there, you have seen a chunk of those movies, but there's still a whole bunch you haven't. And there are some great films and some of them are nice and super long. And rather than you seeing any of those, you're like, oh, here, I got this one that's 2 hours and 45 minutes for you. And it's, you know, it's like, honestly, I think that if more of these critics have seen this film that vote on the BFI, I wouldn't be surprised if they wouldn't get an entry or two, because I'm not saying it's one of the greatest films of all time, but on the BFI criteria, it meets all of that stuff.
It meets the basic criteria of being a completely singular work.
Yes. And also they're very into films that offer up new film language.
Yes, absolutely.
And again, I have to look at examples of, like, you know, this movie is like Zardoz on crack.
Yeah, yeah, but with less of a plot.
But with less of a plot. Though actually, you know, there is a plot, and that's where I think he fails a little bit, maybe because he wasn't interested, but like there's ways that, you know, he put in those inserts of like scenes that he wanted to see. This is why I think this guy is like, he was too far down the rabbit hole of his own movie. But this film probably could have been constructed a little bit, edited down, but like if the film was taken away from the guy and like put the, and then they could have, you know, put some intermediate, like, you know, you hate to do that, narrative text or something, but I think that the film could have been mentioned with these little interludes of like, and then this happened and this happened, and it would have been easier for an audience to digest, because like I said, even if he had filmed the 20% that didn't get to be in the film,
it wouldn't have made a difference. It wouldn't, no, because it's still just this, still completely whacked out. But that's, for me, that was part of the pleasure of it, was just that I kind of let go of it needing to make sense on that plot level, even though there are things like, you know, there's a love story, there's the affair, there's some little political intrigue in the tribe or whatever they're called. And I was caught up enough in the experience of watching the movie that I wasn't as concerned about the plot. And he clearly isn't either, since he basically avoids the plot in dialogue completely.
I did also another visual thing that was cool at the end, right? Because again, this is very biblical. It really does have a lot of allegories right to the Bible, but seeing the stoning was crazy.
Oh my God, yes.
It was nuts. There's just, again, this film has got so many moments that I'm not soon going to forget.
Absolutely, yeah. It is. So you're ultimately glad I picked it.
I don't know if I'd use those words.
Well, that you...
Yeah, I mean...
Okay, let me put it this way. You don't resent me long term for making you watch this.
No. Okay. I mean, again, because it's like I'm always looking to like talk. I mean, it would be one thing if this movie was just a boring slog, and I'm like, great, now what are we going to do to talk about? Because this was not a good movie. But I mean, there's just so much to chew on, and it's all so insane. I mean, again, if you're just looking for pure, absolute insanity,
yeah,
we're not underselling it. It is so insane.
I don't know how you actually sell it. I mean, because we keep saying it's insane, but we're not actually describing the level of the insanity here, because...
Well, my wife was watching it with me, right?
Yeah.
But then she had to go on a trip. She's away on a, you know, a work trip.
Yeah.
So I had to finish it. And I was texting her, I'm saying, you don't even know how much more insane it's gotten than when you last left off. Because she made it right before the new astronaut shows up.
Oh, that's pretty far in. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it was a good hour, but but this is like, you know, there's a lot. It's so much more insane. And to me, when it went off the rails, like just so bizarre, when suddenly you get the other astronaut and he's in the like electric guitar and then that car and I'm just like, okay, man, he's on his own. And then when they went to the when they went to visit the Shuren and it's like this destroyed like Europe rebuilt after World War II, but I'm thinking that cities like Poland didn't quite, and I bet you that's like a blown up city.
Oh, it absolutely is a blown up city. Yeah, it's it was never repaired, and well, and I think that some of what's going on there is allegorical, but it's also just a really cool science fiction idea that like there was once a civilization here, but now it's gone, and it's just the Shuren sort of lurking around.
But it's also like, again, man's hubris that they think that they can show up on a planet and dominate.
Right. Yeah. No, there's a whole aspect of colonialism going on.
Another thing, too, and again, I don't know whether it's something that it's implied, but we never see it. So I didn't know the way that these characters act. There's so much myth going and there's so much fear of the Shurns. They kept talking about like hordes of them flying in. Yeah. And of course, they didn't have the money to do that. But the question is, did those Shurns actually know how to fly? I don't know.
I don't know either. Yeah.
But anyways, listen, we were going on a lot about a Polish film, and it's time to wrap up. So do you have any more parting words or anything else you've got to just get off your chest before we...
I would just say that I recommend this movie for anyone who wants to have a WTF experience.
Yeah, it's totally WTF. And if you're looking for an intense theatrical experience that might give you some things to chew on mentally, Civil War is my recommendation. And so, you know, 2 weeks from now, who knows?
We'll be back with something delightful.
Yep. And again, reminder, I got a few copies coming of my book, Parental Guidance Suggested. And if you want a copy, you can email me at martinsheen at, at jameskent2@icloud.com. But certainly if you reach out to Jim and Teal at gmail.com or stuffweseen.com, whatever, you know, you find us and I see your name and tell me why I should send you a copy, I will.
All right.
And make sure you give me your address because I can't send it to no one. All right. Well,
okay. I think that's it then, huh? That's we'll be back later.
That wraps her up.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, everybody.